This episode of Just the Right Book is brought to you by BetterHelp. Get on your way to being your best self. Give online therapy a try at betterhelp.com/writebook. We are living in stressful times, and the hustle and bustle of the holidays can make it even more stressful. If you're considering starting therapy, try BetterHelp. It's entirely online and designed to be flexible and convenient. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with the best for you licensed therapist. Now is the time to give yourself what you need with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/writebook today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/writebook. This is Roxanne Cody. Thanks for listening. And now back to Just the Right Book.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Just the Right Book, and I'm Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers. Each week, I hope to bring to you the stories behind the books, talking with some of the very best contemporary nonfiction authors, books that are timeless and charming, provocative, and of the moment. The conversations you want to hear about the books you need to read. We may see headlines about private equity firm X buying someone, Toys R Us, Toshiba, Duke Energy, and recently Simon & Schuster. We may also assume that world has nothing to do with our daily lives, just a bunch of business people doing business. But what about if, in fact, that results in our town raising our taxes, or major job layoffs in our community, or impacting the cost or quality of our health care? What if this industry that manages 12 million workers and has assets under its control that are essential to the well-being of our society are in fact endangering our future? This potential damage is explored with details, passion, and a historical perspective in These Are the Plunderers, How Private Equity Runs and Wrecks America, by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gretchen Morgenson and her co-author Joshua Rosner. Gretchen brings her decades-long experience as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, author of several best-selling books, and as a senior financial reporter for NBC to this lively, timely, and important issue. Issues that may have more to do with your quality of life than you think. Gretchen, welcome to Just the Right Book.
Thank you so much for having me. Delighted to open some eyes here.
Well, that's our goal. I think that, you know, as I said in the intro, I think a lot of people feel like, yeah, those guys are making a lot of money, whatever, you know, they're over here, and not quite appreciating the infiltration it has in our day-to-day lives. And what I hope we get to is, what do we hope our listeners or your readers will and can do to act on any of this now that they're informed? But what I want to do is, let's start with the basics.
Okay.
We hear the term private equity firms. I was in the financial world in New York in the 70s and 80s. They were called leverage buyout firms then. Who were the leverage buyout firms, and what do they have to do with today's private equity firms?
Today's private equity firms, Roxanne, are really the LBO guys of the past. They just wanted to have a new name that is maybe a little bit more genteel. Leveraged buyouts, as you remember from the 80s, got sort of a bad reputation because they were often firing a lot of employees. They seemed like they were transactions that were devoted to just making money at the expense of a lot of other people. And that's in fact true. And that's in fact what they continue to do. But so this private equity is really just the old leveraged buyout crew. But really now, so emboldened and so enabled because they have become multi-billionaires. They have trillions of dollars in assets under management. And they have immense control, not only over the economy, but over politicians, over regulators. And so it's a moment, I thought, that was important to look back and check out this history, how it progressed over the last 30, 40 years, and to show people really how this industry, which is kind of stealth, you know, as you point out, people don't know the impact this industry has on you. But for instance, 40% of the nation's emergency departments in hospitals are run by private equity.
Right. So I want to get to that. But first, I want to make sure that our listeners understand sort of the ground up. So a private equity firm comes in and they're buying whom? Are they buying troubled companies? Or are they buying sturdy companies?
Well, historically, they claimed they were buying troubled companies. They would turn them around and then they would sell them at a profit within 5 to 7 years. They would bring their management expertise to a situation where perhaps there had been, you know, a problem or two, and that would be the way that they would shape them up and then ship them out for sale, either as an IPO or to another company. That sort of morphed into where we are now is because we have had so many years of these transactions, it's less about troubled companies than it is simply about companies that they take over that are doing fine, but they think that they can make them be more profitable, more efficient, and so therefore be able to sell them for more than they paid after, you know, 5 to 7 years. So perfect example, Simon & Schuster, my publisher of The Plunderers, it is a profitable company, and yet it was just announced that KKR is going to be taking it over. So in the beginning, they were more focused on troubled companies. Now it's really about very kind of minor efficiencies or economies of scale that they can bring. But also it's about tapping into businesses that have immense amounts of money at play, which brings us to healthcare. But let's first explain how it works. A company, a private equity firm buys a company. It puts a lot of debt on that company to do the transaction. It's not the private equity firm taking on the debt. It's the company itself. Okay, so that's important. They then say that they're going to improve the operations, you know, make them more efficient. What often happens is they fire lots of workers, they offload pension obligations, these kinds of financial engineering transactions that make the company more efficient, and then they hope to sell it at a profit.
So Gretchen, let's just break that down. So I'm selling my company to private equity firm for $1 billion. So the first thing that happens is I'm really the seller, the company that's being sold, I'm really going to be carrying the debt that was used to buy the company.
Correct. You the owner. Okay, so the owner, let's just separate out the owner from the employees and from the company that remains. Okay, so let's say I, you know, created this really fantastic company and they buy it for $1 billion. I'm the one who gets out. I'm no longer on the scene generally. They usually have me stay around on the board for a couple of years, that kind of thing. But what's left is, so I get rich, the company owner gets rich, and the people who are left, i.e. the employees, who have really made the company what it is, right? They're the ones, and the company operations, They're the ones that are left holding this debt. Okay. The company employees don't own the debt, but the company itself is sagging under this debt immediately.
Right.
Which is a huge expense for them that they didn't probably have before.
Okay, so does the private equity firm at that point take out any money? Because if they're destroying the company they bought, how do they go about making money? They're making a lot of money. So where are they getting their money?
Good question. Okay, private equity firm raises a fund, puts together billions of dollars in a so-called fund. They go to public pensions, they go to endowments, and other institutional investors and say, would you like to invest in my fund? I have a great track record. I've done X, Y, and Z. My performance is fantastic. Do you want to go into this new fund that I'm creating? And all the pension funds say, yes, 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 because in the past, maybe the performance has been okay. And so the private equity firm only ends up putting 1 to 2% of its own money in this. Okay. So their skin in the game is very modest, nominal. It's the pension funds, it's the endowments, it's the institutions whose money is at stake. Okay. Now, when the company has to amass all this debt in order to pay for the transaction, the firm often takes out a lot of money right off the bat. And so they're almost ahead of the game immediately. Okay. And their investors are winning also, frankly, because they're all in it together. The fund has, you know, billions of dollars. The private equity firm is only in it to the extent of 1% to 2%. And the other whole is made up by CalPERS, CalSTRS, you know, New York State Common Retirement
Fund,
et cetera.
Big pension funds.
Big, huge pension funds, right. And so the company then immediately starts to struggle. Because it now has this enormous debt load that it has to service. It has to pay. It's like a mortgage. You have to pay it every, you know, month. But you also have to pay it back over time. So that's a pressure point on the company that it probably didn't have prior to the acquisition. So then the company has to become more efficient, if only to pay for that debt, right? So that means oftentimes firing employees. It means having fewer staff in a nursing home. And one of the most really upsetting academic research pieces that I read when writing this book was about nursing homes that are taken over by private equity. And after when the private equity firm is involved in a nursing home, mortality rates are 10% higher than if the nursing home is not owned by private equity. So this is a perfect example of what happens. They reduce the staff. They don't have the people necessary to care for the patients in the nursing home because perhaps they're paying this debt load. Or in another case involving a nursing home company, the private equity firm sold the real estate that the nursing home company owned, on which all of its nursing homes sat. And so Carlyle in that case was the private equity firm.
That was Manor Care.
It sold the underlying real estate. Carlyle profited immediately, got all of its money back from its initial investment in Manor Care. But immediately, Manor Care had enormous rent costs that they had not had before. And this pushed the company into bankruptcy. Now, Carlyle wasn't hurt by the bankruptcy because they had already made their money and then some. But the company, the employees, the patients, all of the other stakeholders were really harmed by that transaction.
So, Gretchen, I want to break this down and get some data because you've got, you know, your co-author has done a lot of research and accumulated a lot of data. So I want to clarify a couple of things. One is not all private equity firms are doing leverage buyouts. So we need to, there are private equity firms that are long-term holders adding value. So that's a segment of the industry.
That's right.
What segment of the industry and under assets managed are doing leverage buyouts in the old school way? Do you know what percentage that would be?
Well, I would say it's the dominant force in private equity, Roxanne, because first of all, you have Apollo, KKR, Blackstone, Bain,
Carlyle.
Okay, so these are huge entities. So if you just put them together and as like assets under management, they're going to be the dominant force in private equity. So the companies that are doing a better job, i.e. they're not leveraging up, they're not putting all this debt on a company, they are taking the longer view, as you note, they put their own equity, they put more of their own money at stake. Those kinds of firms are smaller. And so they're having less of an impact. These big players really, really drive the industry and are the force to be reckoned with and the reason why we wrote the book.
And Gretchen, one more data point. Do we know the difference in the percentages of companies that go bankrupt in the general planet versus those that are owned by private equity firms?
There is reliable research that shows that companies that are bought out in these very leveraged transactions fail and go bankrupt at 10 times the rate.
Right.
Of companies that are not purchased.
10 times.
10 times.
Yeah. I mean, that was a stunning data point to me in the book that confirms your proposition. Now let's go into the healthcare. So you indicate in the book that private equity firms now own at least 11% of nursing homes.
Right.
But the scarier number is they now manage 40% of the emergency rooms in the country.
Correct.
So there's two strands of conversation I'd like to have here. One is the idea that companies or industries that are part of the social well-being of our lives, like hospitals, when did they shift into becoming for-profit entities?
Well, I would say that it really started in the late 90s. HCA is a for-profit health hospital company, and it's the biggest hospital chain in the United States. They have roughly 180 hospitals across the country. You know, in the old days, hospitals were run by either religious organizations, they were community hospitals run by a town or a county, they were nonprofits. But that has almost completely changed and flipped. And now, even those that are continue to be called nonprofits operate like for-profits. They pay their chief executives very well. They have the same kind of pursuit of profits that the for-profit hospital systems do. So I would say it really began in earnest in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And then the pursuit of these companies by private equity really took off in the mid-2000s, so 2006 and beyond. And so that's when you started to see really the pursuit of this. And there's a very good reason for it, Roxanne. I mean, healthcare is 18% of gross domestic product in this country. And that's a huge money pot. And you have government programs that are enormous and that really are kind of like a money spigot that these companies look at as something they want to tap into. So healthcare is a huge issue. It's a moneymaker for them. But as you point out, it's a social good. And so it is really at conflict.
And Gretchen, I want to add another element. Like when you talk about once Carlyle owned ManorCare, and I assume it's representative, the other thing that started going on is the Medicare billings
right.
grew at some exponential rate. So part of I think you say in the book, healthcare was 7% of the gross national product back in the 70s, and it's close to 18% now. We're not going to cover all the reasons that it's gone up. Is one that these corporations that are now controlling emergency rooms and nursing homes are doing excessive Medicare billings?
Absolutely. I mean, the ManorCare situation had an enormous investigation by the Justice Department. The Justice Department wound up flubbing the case. But I talked to one of the whistleblowers in that case, and she had just absolute horror stories to tell about how ManorCare was defrauding Medicare and pretending that these patients were going through this very high cost therapy, even though some of them were like comatose, right? And so they weren't really going through the therapy at all, but the government, and that means you and me, the taxpayers, were paying for this. So Medicare fraud is an enormous issue in the ManorCare case. But yes, it's a reason why you saw the surprise billing problem occur in emergency rooms, right?
So explain that.
Okay, so Envision, which is a company owned by KKR, which went bankrupt earlier this year. Envision is a company that is one of the two main players in emergency department staffing. A very comprehensive research project at Yale University studied what happened after Envision took over the management of a hospital emergency department. And what it found was they would remove the emergency department from the insurance, accepted insurance that the hospital would take. So you, a patient, would think that you would be going to your hospital and you would be covered by your insurance. But Envision came up with this mechanism to extricate the emergency department from that insurance coverage. It was out of network. And you had to pay the difference between what the insurer would pay and what they were charging. And the bills were astronomical.
Has this changed? Was there a regulatory?
Yes. So this became such an outrage. It made people so angry that Congress actually had to do something about it. And so you had a bipartisan, believe it or not, action by Congress to have something called the No Surprises Act, which went into effect, I believe, in 21. It didn't solve the entire problem, but it really started to get at the problem. And this is why Envision went bankrupt, okay? So you have a really interesting case in point where Envision was gouging patients, right? They were overcharging them, making them pay up. It was then stopped by a law, and then Envision goes bankrupt. So their secret sauce, as it were, was sort of making patients pay more than they otherwise would have. That's the kind of thing that when you look at it in its bare bones, you say to yourself, how is this allowed to happen in American healthcare?
So Gretchen, let's just follow this thread, because if that law was passed, will private equity firms now stop buying or stop managing emergency rooms because their gateway to extracting profits has been closed?
Well, they'll find other ways. They'll find other ways to maintain those profits. Now, Envision went bankrupt.
Chapter 11 or 7?
Chapter 11. So they are going to reorganize and maybe, and actually HCA has a joint venture with them. So I think that they're going to emerge, as a company, but they're not, certainly not liquidating. But so these are very creative people. They're very smart people. They're very shrewd, and they'll figure out a way to, generate profits because that is their goal. It's a requirement for their business model. And so my argument, Roxanne, is this a sustainable business model? is it a sustainable business model when your basic secret sauce is to kind of fool people into having to pay higher costs to make an emergency room visit? You know, you're at your most vulnerable. You're either, you know, you're in an emergency situation, you're ill, whatever it is, you're in an accident. It's just really stunning that you had this kind of a business model that tried to take advantage of that. Is that a sustainable business model? Well, it's not, because Envision had to file for bankruptcy.
This episode of Just the Right Book is brought to you by BetterHelp. Get on your way to being your best self. Give online therapy a try at betterhelp.com/writebook. We are living in stressful times, and the hustle and bustle of the holidays can make it even more stressful. If you're considering starting therapy, try BetterHelp. It's entirely online and designed to be flexible and convenient. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with the best for you licensed therapist. Now is the time to give yourself what you need with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/writebook today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/writebook. This is Roxanne Cody. Thanks for listening. And now back to Just the Right Book.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So I have a series of questions. One is, we have to, in thinking about how this gets solved, we're a capitalistic economy.
Yep.
And somewhere we have to balance the tension between capitalism as a generator of jobs, as a way of being innovative, with the notion that a corporation has stakeholders other than the shareholders, namely
Correct.
The community and the employees. And the trend over the last 20 years has been that the only stakeholder that matters to a corporation are the shareholders. And
Correct.
From that, all other good will come. And I think that the damage that you've talked about has gotten some traction in the news, and people are understanding it. So one of the conversations I had earlier this year was with Alan Murray, who's with
Fortune,
and wrote a book called Tomorrow's Capitalism. His contention is that today's CEO is beginning to understand that the other stakeholders add to the whole well-being of a corporation and therefore society. Do you think that's really going to happen, or do you think that the regulatory environment really needs to change?
I think both things. Okay. So, you know, my hat is off to Alan if he believes that CEOs are starting to get the message on this. I'm very happy to hear that. He is more plugged into the CEO network than I am. I don't usually get my calls returned when I reach out. So if he's saying that's happening, hallelujah, I would say. Amen. And finally, because we've had, as you say, decades of this notion that, you know, the shareholders are the only entity that matters, and therefore everything else will just accrue if we take care of the shareholders. Obviously not the case. We're starting to see union activity heating up. Employees are finally having a little bit more leverage, or gaining a little bit more leverage with management. you know, the UAW strike is very interesting going on right now. So you are seeing shifts away from this notion and the outcomes, which have been very one-sided, meaning employees had very few options. They were really put upon. They did not have alternatives that they could look at. So we are starting to see that interest. And I think that power shift may be starting to get a little bit more balanced. But the regulators really need to step up their game. I mean, they have let these people run amok. And you're starting to see it finally with the FTC. Now, as you know, the FTC is our antitrust watchdog in the country. It is charged with making sure that when companies are acquired in mergers, acquisitions, that there is not a sense of monopolistic power that's accruing to the person making the acquisition. And so the FTC is watching closely. They, I think 2 weeks ago, just sued a private equity-backed anesthesia partner staffing company that they claimed had dominated the market in Texas, had monopolized the market in Texas, raising prices for patients and diminishing care for patients. And this is a very interesting case to watch because it's really the first under Biden's FTC chairwoman, Lina Khan, and she's taking a much more aggressive stance than any FTC has in the last decades with private equity. See, the problem is you normally would only have acquisitions looked at that are very high dollar amount, you know, in the hundreds of millions. And private equity firms kind of buy up these small doctors' practices, and they don't meet that threshold that the FTC would normally be looking at. And so what she's done is she says, but wait a minute, you still get monopolistic power, even if you're buying small, low dollar amount acquisitions, you can still gain that kind of pernicious monopoly power. And so we've got to stop that.
There was a bill introduced by the Senate and the House whose title cracked me up, which was Stop Wall Street Looting Act.
Yeah.
That was literally the name of a bill that had support in the House and the Senate. But so what did that bill try to do and what happened to that bill?
Well, that bill has died a couple of times, I think. It's a great idea because there are some elements in there that can really could really help put a stop to some of this activity. One of the things in that bill that could really help is it would bar acquirers from being able to extract cash from companies they acquire and then put a lot of debt on. So that very kind of transaction that we talked about a little bit earlier, where a company is bought, it has to take on all this debt to fund the acquisition, and then the private equity firm takes money out, those kinds of transactions would be barred for a period of time. So you couldn't get that immediate payday that is so problematic because of the debt that's heaped onto the company. So that was one piece of those bills that I thought could really make a difference. But, you know, the other thing that would really stop a lot of this in its tracks is if you got rid of the tax loophole that these people enjoy, which is called the carried interest loophole, in which people, multi-billionaires like Steve Schwarzman of Blackstone, pay a much, much lower income tax rate than I do or you do or a bus driver or a school teacher does because of the way their business is treated and their income is treated as a capital gain.
But Gretchen, there have been maybe five serious efforts to repeal. Even Trump wanted to try to repeal carried interest. So what carried interest does is it treats what's basically earned income as if it's capital gain income, which is a substantially lower rate.
Yeah.
But the lobbying effort to stop that seems to be at an insurmountable level unless broad amounts of ordinary non private equity leveraged buyout firms really got serious about barraging their representatives with the need to do this. One of the challenges, it seems to me, Gretchen, in stopping this or having a regulatory environment that would limit it is that the same consolidation that is occurring in the business world creates untoward lobbying powers to make sure that the laws stay in a way that are beneficial to those consolidators.
That's right. Perfect.
So what is it that we as like regular people can do to stop or overturn the environment that allows all of that to happen?
We can do very little, unfortunately, Roxanne. We can write to our congresspeople. That's probably a joke. The last time that this was tried to get rid of the loophole, the tax loophole, Kyrsten Sinema single-handedly stopped it. She's in Arizona. She was a Democrat. You know, the private equity firms paid her $1.5 million and they got that done. So yes, they have enormous, enormous pools of capital that they can use to manipulate outcomes. They did not manipulate the outcome, however, on the No Surprises Act, because they couldn't, because people were so outraged and people were so familiar with the problem and were so, you know, just beyond angry that they literally, Congress was sort of shamed into doing something about it. So you have to get that kind of a groundswell of anger and rage before anything is going to get done. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to get this information out there to people was so they would understand what's happening. This has been stealth. This takeover of our economy has been stealthy. People don't know that the veterinarian they go to is maybe private equity owned, or the fast food joint that they go to is private equity owned, or the kindergarten where they send their child. I mean, the nursing home, it's everywhere. And so I wanted people to understand how pervasive and pernicious this business model is so that they can start to ask questions. And you can say, are you, to your veterinarian, are you private equity owned? Because, you know, if you are, I think I might want to go to the guy down the street. Because all the research shows that costs increase, that the amount of labs that are done increase so that the costs increase. You have less time with the physician. You have more time with physician extenders, which are, you know, lower cost employees. All the research shows that this is what happens when private equity gets involved. And so just knowing that and maybe being able to ask questions, but they are in control. I mean, the fantastic book about the RJR Nabisco deal was called Barbarians at the Gate. Well, the barbarians are at the controls. They are no longer at the gate. They're at the controls.
So, Gretchen, a couple of questions so that, you know, we have enough bad news in the world as we're recording this.
Yes, yes.
I want to at least give a nod to those who have criticized your book for being one-sided. What would these private equity firms, or what have they said in public or to you in their defense?
Well, yeah, I of course engaged or tried to engage with all of them. You know, the book is really relies heavily on documents, very unbiased and reliable research, et cetera. And it's really, we've had decades now that we can kind of look longitudinally back on what happens with these takeovers. So in all cases with these big firms, I went to them and I said, look, my thesis is that you are a destructive force in capitalism, that you get rich and everybody else suffers, even down to school children in Missouri who go without books because of a company that you bankrupted. So I was very clear about my thesis. They, of course, all said they disagreed with the thesis. We create jobs. We don't trash jobs. we don't go bankrupt at the rate that you are showing in the research, et cetera. So Blackstone was particularly aggressive and said, as a matter of fact, we have created 200,000 net new jobs at our portfolio companies that we own as private equity firm in the last 15 years. And I said, boy, that's really interesting. That's fantastic. That shows that you are a job creator, not a job destroyer. Please send me the data. Silence.
Mm.
And then a couple of days later, I got, we respectfully decline to send you the data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So all I can think of is, okay, well, there really is no data that shows 200,000 net new jobs, because if there was, you'd send it to me.
Right.
And
right.
I'd say, oh, look at this. They actually create jobs. So, you know, they have arguments to make, but the arguments that they make to me do not hold water.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can see the impact in enough pockets of the country and in enough pockets of the economy to conclude that these are not people who are considering all the stakeholders, as you noted at the beginning of the interview. These are not people who believe that they want the people on the other side of the transaction to benefit as much as they do. This is a kind of an I, me, mine capitalism. And I don't think that there is much that really shows otherwise. They can tell me that they created 200,000 net new jobs, but they can't show me that they did. And that speaks volumes to me.
The other piece of this that we have not yet seen blow up, that I'll be curious to watch its evolution. You know, when I read the book, I also think about enablers, right? Who's complicit in, because they benefit directly or indirectly from this. So one enabler are sellers of companies, right? They have they may or may not have a choice, but they end up selling out to a firm that they know damn well what's going to happen, but they've taken their, you know, slice of heaven and they've gone home. But right. The other is corporate debt is being issued,
right,
that enables these transactions to take place. Somebody owns that corporate debt. When these companies go bankrupt, who's losing out when those corporate debts blow up?
The people losing out are the people who own those bonds, and that's oftentimes going to be institutions, mutual funds, you know, endowments, et cetera. We're in an interesting moment of time right now, Roxanne, and that is interest rates have gone up considerably. We are now starting to feel the pain of this. You're seeing it in mortgage rates. People can't afford to move or buy a new house because they can't afford the mortgage. This is going to have a big impact on the business model of private equity because it's really about the easy money terms in the debt markets that really facilitated this pursuit of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in deals. So we're at a period of time when that is now screeching to a halt. You're starting to see bankruptcies. Envision is an example. Another is, there are just all kinds of them. And they're teetering. Companies that have not filed for bankruptcy are teetering because these companies issue floating rate debt. They don't issue fixed rate debt. And so their debt costs are rising every time the Federal Reserve raises interest rates. So we're at a moment in time where this business model is under pressure. And I think we're going to start to be able to see that much more clearly because of what's going on in interest rates. This is a business model that requires zero interest rates. It requires no, you know, regulatory scrutiny. And I think those days, I hope, are over. And the last piece of it is the investors, who are the pension funds.
The pension funds. Because just so our listeners understand this piece of it, pension funds back some years ago began diversifying their portfolios to invest in what were called alternative assets, which included, among other things, private equity firms. And for a good part of the past 10 or 15 years, those, in fact, right here in New Haven, David Swenson at the Yale Endowment was a big proponent. And that, in fact, fueled enormous growth in the rates of returns that pension funds and endowments enjoyed. As I was reading this, you can't help but wonder if the pivot on that is going to be as dramatic as the benefit was.
Yes. Well, you now have the situation where the alpha, the difference between what a private equity fund would return versus the stock market or the bond market. And for years, as you point out, it was higher. The returns were better. And that's why pension funds just poured money into this business model. Those days are also over. The returns of private equity have now reverted to the mean. It is now on a par with an S&P 500 index fund, which is low cost, totally transparent, and completely liquid, so you can sell it at any time. So these funds, I think pensions are going to really have to start looking at these investments with a different cold eye because the returns are diminishing. And so you take on the immense risks of illiquidity, not being able to sell. You take on the risks of whatever is going on at the companies that might hurt the workers, the pensioners, the towns in which they operate, the bankruptcies, et cetera. You're really going to have to start looking at this as, do we want to be involved, particularly if we're not making as much money as we used to?
So, Gretchen, we're winding down and we covered a lot of territory. I'm a little bit concerned that we haven't left the listener with clarity on what their takeaway from this conversation ought to be, and how is it that they could either protect themselves going to an emergency room, or if they have someone they know in a nursing home, what can they do or what should they be aware of after reading your book or listening to our conversation?
Well, a couple of ideas. One is private equity firms are now targeting high net worth individuals, wealthy people who are not, you know, billionaires, but who have a nice nest egg, because they're trying to expand the amount of their customer base. So one thing you can do is don't invest with private equity, because this is a business model that really can punish all the other stakeholders while benefiting a very, very tiny slice or small number of people who are at the helm. You can ask when you are interviewing nursing homes, or it's hard to go into the emergency department and say, are you run
by bleeding.
Yeah, you can't. That's not possible. That's not possible. In fact, it's very hard for me to identify as an investigative reporter to identify which emergency departments are run by these private equity firms. It's very difficult. Okay. So forget it. That's a non-starter. You can ask if your veterinarian is, you can ask if the nursing home is, you can ask if the, after school program or the reading program or anything is owned by private equity, because chances are your dermatologist, for instance, very big, your anesthesiologist. I mean, it's really pervasive, and the impact on the patient is so dramatic that you can and should ask in all of these cases, in all, you know, the healthcare world. But wow, it's really, really hard, because they have gained control. And, you know, what are you going to do? As you say, you're bleeding, you're at the emergency department, you're not going to be able to walk away and go somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm not going to say, before you treat me as I'm bleeding out, I'd like to know if you're managed by a private equity firm. I mean, I guess you could do it prophylactically by the emergency room you would go to when you don't need one. You could try and figure it out. I mean, I've heard you say that one way to figure it out is to go to Envision or Telehealth's website and see if they have job openings at your local emergency room, because that'll tell you that they're managed by them. But I guess you don't have a lot of hope for us as individuals getting the attention of our legislators.
Well, tell me why I'm wrong about that.
Well, okay, you are hopeful.
Well, you know, I don't think it can't hurt, okay?
Right.
It can't hurt to it actually worked in the no surprises situation.
Yeah.
That got done. Change did occur. And believe me, they were pouring money into it.
Yeah.
To try to combat the issue. And it had bad outcomes for them. So,
yeah,
it can happen. It can happen. But the outrage has to be so severe and so palpable.
Yeah. And the outrage, my experience and observation is outrage happens when it really impacts you. So right. On the surprise billings, you had a lot of people that were doing it. If they start to see more of that in their emergency room, if nursing care deaths seem to increase under the auspices of private equity firms, I mean, it seems to me people only act when it really is literally in their pocketbook or inside their house or affecting them or a family member. So it's almost as if it has to get so bad that people will act.
That's right. They only put up a stop sign or a red light at a corner where there have been X number of deaths. Okay. So things have to get so bad that people say just no more.
Yeah. One hopeful note, I think, is, you know, Lena Khan to me is a hero because she has reversed what were decades of people thinking that monopolies were fine as long as it produced a lower cost to the consumer. And it seems to me this FTC department under her leadership is thinking about the world of business in a more macro way that's impacting or contributing to inequality in healthcare, inequality in incomes. So, you know, maybe there's some hope there.
Oh, definitely. I couldn't agree with you more. She is really taking on the big guns here. And my hat is off to her for that. And this case that she brought on this anesthesia staffing company is really going to be a great test case. Because typically, I mean, even in the Medicare fraud case involving ManorCare, these prosecutors never go up the ladder. They never go up to, okay, who owns the company? Who owns ManorCare? And why are these people overcharging Medicare? You know, they never take it to the next level of what the corporation or the CEO or the management is requiring that these companies do in the way of generate profits.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that she sued a private equity firm as part of this case was very meaningful and important.
Mm-hmm. So, Gretchen, here's what I think I would close with. One is, thank you for putting together this book. I think you've got lots of anecdotes. We didn't even get into Drexel and the executive life because that could have taken up an entire hour. But I would encourage our readers to read the book. I think you've got a lot of detailed examples in there that will help people maybe begin to look at what's going on around them in even a slightly different way. And those things, I think, become accretive in what people notice and how they act on them and how they talk to each other about it. So I always like to be optimistic about things, and I think the first step in change is knowledge. And I
Absolutely.
Think that's what you're bringing us.
Thank you. I hope that that is an outcome. I just want people to understand that there are downsides to these transactions. We read about these billionaires. We read constantly about them. There's a lot of, you know, very lavish praise for these people as being astute business people. But we never read about the people who are on the other side of the transaction. We never read about the people on the other side of the table. And so that's what I really wanted to explore. And that's what I really wanted to expose, because those are real people and they have lives that have been impacted. And, you know, it could happen to you next.
Right.
And so that's what I really wanted to get out there. And so thank you for your interest. And I really, really appreciate our conversation.
Great. We've been talking with Gretchen Morgenson, the author of These Are the Plunderers, How Private Equity Runs and Wrecks America. Gretchen Morgenson, keep up the good work and thanks for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Just the Right Book is not just a podcast. JustTheRightBook.com is a highly personalized book subscription service. It's good for readers of all ages. We have decades and decades of bookselling experience at RJ Julia's, and they're the ones who are selecting these books. Here's what happens. We get tons and tons of letters. We've been around for over 10 years, and the letters always are a version of this. I can't believe you picked out this book. I would have never picked it out. And guess what? It was just the right book. So visit justtherightbook.com for details and begin your subscription today. Of course, we have a promo code for you. So if you go to justtherightbook.com, use the promo code podcast, and you will get 15% off on your subscription at justtherightbook.com. You are listening to Just the Right Book with Roxanne Cody, brought to you by Lit Hub Radio, produced by Roxanne Cody and Michael Selleck. Our editor is Gino Cordone at pleasantpodcast.com. The original theme music is by Kurt Feldman. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can email me any comments, suggestions, observations. We would love to hear from you. Email me at podcast@rjjulia.com. I do hope you will subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Just the Right Book Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.